Across America, over 105,000 persons have died from opioid abuse during the last year. And although the Support Act has expired and awaits renewal, the fight against fentanyl and all opioids still continues unabated 24/7. Greetings again. I'm Adam Morgan. On this edition, we take a moment to brief ourselves on how this work fighting addiction is taking place here in our state. Heading the efforts is the Colorado Consortium for Prescription Drug Abuse Prevention. The director of the consortium is our guest, Mr. Jose Escobar.
You know, the Consortium for Prescription Drug Abuse Prevention, of which I serve as director, and then Dr. Rob Valick, who's a professor at the School of Pharmacy, serves as the executive director. This consortium has been around now since 2013, but very fortunately, it really got its launch way back around 2010-11 with a state plan to address what was then the prescription drug abuse problem, mainly the opioid prescription drug problem, with some leadership from Governor Hickenlooper and also from Attorney General John Southers, who was then serving in that role. And I happened to have the privilege of serving as a vice chair of prevention of a what was then a meth task force for the state that was chaired by Attorney General Southers. But
yeah,
he was interested in looking at these other drug issues, and prescription drugs was starting to be a problem for us back in 2009. And this consortium came about as a way to look at a coordinated effort to respond to that opioid crisis. But we've seen that crisis evolve over the years, and it evolved into the heroin issue, now the fentanyl. But the approach has been to pull together people from different disciplines that were being affected by this addiction problem related to opioids and bring that expertise to the table to consider and think about the responses of how do we respond to this? How do we change the trend?
Yeah.
And so that's what that group was really put together to do, is to look at the different strategies. Now, we laid a lot of good groundwork because we didn't start doing the litigations until 2016-17. At that point, I was serving in the state attorney general's office under Attorney General Kaufman, and she began to do some of the work in the state around litigation and looking at suing these companies that had produced these this problem through their opioid manufacturing and distribution. And, you know, back then we had an eye for, well, how are these dollars going to get used? So we did some work with the state legislature to update our drug policies in the state so that we can make better use of these funds for treatment and recovery and prevention, and began to lay that groundwork. And I have to give a lot of credit to Attorney General Weiser when he came into office and took over this work and continued the litigation and this recommendation, because even under Kaufman, we were thinking, you know, this money really to be put to good use. Not only do we need the good policies and the evidence-based strategies to do good things with it, but we want to see most of this money go out to the local people
rather than
it be seen at the state. Because oftentimes, as good-hearted as state people are, and I've been a state employee for many years, as good-hearted as we are, we don't have a finger on the pulse of what's going on locally. And as you mentioned, our state is big, and there's so many different issues, and these people know their communities better. And so I think one of the things that really I'm hoping to see success in is the fact that these dollars from the settlements are going out to these 19 regions. And besides the work that Attorney General Weiser and his staff did, Colorado Counties Inc., Colorado Municipal League brought leaders together as well to advocate for a system that would allow the majority of these settlement dollars to be administered, or at least to be decided at the local level how best to spend them.
Yeah.
And therefore, the southeast part of the state, they know better their culture, their people, to figure out what can we do with the dollars. The metro area, they have a different culture and different feel for what the issues are here, and allow the local folks to make some decisions. Now, here's where the consortium comes in, though, is that we have a large network of subject matter experts, people who understand these different strategies or understand some of the root causes of this issue related to addiction and opioids.
Yeah.
And so our consortium really then serves a role to help educate these folks at the local level about what are the best strategies based in science that we know are going to make a difference, and then how can we help you to take a look at that and plan to implement those using those dollars.
I guess the question comes to mind then, as the dollars flow, is there a certain percentage that just stays with the organization and the operation? Is the majority of the money going to locals to really help people who need to be in programs of treatment that need alternatives there?
80% is definitely going out to the local regional folks to make decisions about
how
they decide to use the 80%. So if we're looking at over 18 years, about $740 million. So 80% of that's definitely going out to the local people to decide. Now, there's some guidelines. There is an agreement with a memorandum of understanding between the local regional abatement councils and the Attorney General's office, because that's where the money's being, you know, administered, or the approval for the use of the money. They have an MOU that says, look, the funds can be used for these purposes, and they have outlined purposes in the areas of prevention, what we call harm reduction, treatment, recovery. And it's going to be up to them to decide where they want to go. But I can tell you the majority of the folks are concerned about the people who need the services and treatment. And so they have that opportunity to allocate those funds locally to help those individuals who are in the midst of an addiction and support those treatment services that are in their county, or to increase them if they're not as available as they need to be.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sure, or at least determine, that, you know, the funds are going to the people who need it and don't end up in the municipal general fund going for parks and highways, you know.
Yeah, now it's a good point, because we saw this happen with the tobacco settlement funds, in which, you know, states were given these dollars around the lawsuit with the tobacco companies.
Yeah.
And we saw only 2 or 3 or 4% ended up going to actually prevention or intervention around tobacco, and most of it did go to these other types of things. No, that's one thing at the national level. They made sure to set these parameters that, that the majority of these dollars, even if they were overseen by a legislature, the vast majority of dollars must go out to address the opioid crisis issue directly, not into roads, not into bridges, not into anything else. And so in our state, you know, even that, that 20% that stays with the state, there's 10% that's intended for infrastructure development at the local level. So the state is only getting 10% of these funds. The majority is going out, and they must be used for some sort of mitigation and abatement of the opioid crisis.
I think I saw that the consortium has 10 work groups. I think you mentioned one of them is a harm reduction. Is how is that done? Is that a building and an awareness campaign among the general public that they can be harmed, what's going on? How does harm reduction?
I'll explain that topic, because the campaign work is really done more under prevention and public awareness about these concerns. But harm reduction is actually a strategy that's been around for a while. Now, it's sometimes a little challenging for people to understand, but I can help people understand what that means. Let's start just with harm reduction in general. If you think about things like seatbelts, or helmets when you ride a bicycle, these are strategies that are intended to reduce harm from injury for folks by keeping them safe somehow, some way. Traffic lights are a form of harm reduction, because you don't want people crashing into each other somehow, some way. And there's a variety of things like that. Now, when it comes to substance use and abuse, and particularly with opioids, harm reduction is something different. And harm reduction, it's the same kind of concept, that you want to keep people safe. But it really is intended to be a strategy for people who are in the throes of an addiction.
Uh-huh.
And perhaps some of the listeners here have family members that have experienced addiction, or perhaps they themselves have been in addiction and are now in recovery. But you find that this can be a very challenging effort. When people are in addiction, their brains have changed, and they often know what they're doing is hurting them, and they know it's not the right thing to do. But the way their brain has changed, they crave the drug, and they must have the drug. And at times, these people are not quite ready to get to treatment, or maybe they've gone to treatment and then they've come back out and they're using again. But what harm reduction does is the goal of that is to reduce harm from spread of disease. So if people are doing shooting drugs with a needle, we don't want them to share dirty needles. If they're using pipes and sharing pipes, we want them to have pipes that aren't going to spread disease. Or, the harm reduction that we're doing right now, mostly in our state, is this distribution of something called naloxone, or Narcan, or Kloxxado. It's a safe drug that helps to reverse an overdose death, because our main concern with the opioid crisis has been the increase in the number of deaths related to drug overdose, particularly due to opioid. So harm reduction, although it can be challenging for people to understand, the idea is we want to keep people alive.
Yeah.
And if you talk to anyone who's lost a loved one, to an overdose death, they'll tell you that even though they tried to get their loved one help and they weren't ready, there are plenty of stories of where people have been revived with something like naloxone and eventually do get to treatment and then get into recovery. The important thing is, let's keep people alive until they're ready to get the treatment.
That's
harm reduction.
You mentioned something that doesn't get talked about a lot. In fact, it's not even mentioned a lot. When you said that people in addiction, their brains change.
Yes.
Are people even aware of that?
You know, the change happens in such a way that people don't even realize it.
Yeah.
They'll know that something's happening. But what they're going to feel mostly is the craving for the drug. They may not even realize to what degree their brain has been altered.
Yeah.
So that really the thing to do, and I think it's been difficult for our society and for people to understand that substance use addiction, whether it's to alcohol, whether it's to any other drug, cocaine or methamphetamines or to opioids or fentanyl, it changes the brain in such a way that this is really a brain disorder. It's a disease of the brain. And again, it's really remarkable to the point that people really believe that they may be okay, that I'm really okay. I really like the feeling of the drug. The thing is, when people get so deep into their drug use, they're not even using anymore to get high. They're simply using to feel normal. And that's where you know that the brain has really changed. It's like, this is not even so much to get high anymore. It's like, I can't go through withdrawal. I just have to feel normal because my brain just needs this drug to feel normal. That's addiction.
Is that one of the things that's driving the high rates of drug overdose, which can lead to death? Is their brains are changed and I need more, but I think I'm okay. And so they take more and more and they take too much.
Exactly. You've got it. You pinned it down just right for people to understand. Now, there's a couple things happening here, and I'll explain this one piece because that certainly has been the way that it has worked, particularly with prescribed drugs. Many people were prescribed an opioid, and it doesn't take long for people to get addicted to an opioid prescribed drug. It's really surprising how quickly that can happen in terms of the brain adjusting to it. But then when they try to stop, they have these withdrawal symptoms, and then they got to have that more feeling again.
Yeah.
Now with fentanyl, what's really curious is that, you know, the drug fentanyl is so much more potent as an opioid, very potent, so much so that it's a dangerous drug. And you have some circumstances where people are addicted to an opioid and they want that stronger feeling, or it's cheaper. It's fentanyl is so cheap to acquire, either in a pill form or a powder form, that you know, to get that high, they don't have to spend hundreds of dollars. But there are other cases of opioid overdose deaths where someone maybe has not been addicted. They simply went out to party sometime and someone just gave them a pill. And they didn't realize that it had fentanyl in it, and then they would overdose. So not every one of these overdoses are related to addiction. Many are, but there's also this concern about unintentional. And this is where we've been working on public awareness campaigns across the state with younger people now. Unfortunately, we have to do that education with young people now in the high schools, in the colleges. There's some work going on to educate young people in the colleges.
Yeah.
About how to keep themselves safe, how to be prepared for this, not to take these kind of pills if they don't know what they're taking, because they could unintentionally die. Or if they are in a situation where they're at a party and someone does appear to be overdosing, make sure they have Narcan or naloxone or Kloxxado, one of the forms of a nasal naloxone, to save a life.
For people who are planning their own party, you know, and even with Halloween showing up here, having some of those reversal medications is probably something you need to put on your list, you know, to stick in the medicine cabinet in case you use it, because you may know everybody who comes there, but there's somebody who you don't know, and something like that might happen.
Yes, and, you know, and the consortium right now, we've been working on a campaign called Keep the Party Safe. It's really intended for people ages around 25 to 45 that might be people going out to have just a good time, either to a concert or to a party or somewhere. And, you know, people, again, unsuspectingly, someone may say, hey, here's a pill, make you feel good just for the night, have a good time. But it couldn't contain fentanyl. So, yes, we do want people to, you know, I think we are at that point in our society that people can do something to save a life. If you care about your friends or people, acquire some naloxone. You can get those from a harm reduction organization in your community. They now are offering and selling it over the counter in some of the pharmacies, whether it's Walgreens or CVS or any of the local pharmacies may be carrying it, that you can acquire it.
Mr. Jose Escobel, he's the director of the Colorado Consortium for Prescription Drug Abuse Prevention and our expert guest on this edition. Our focus is the assistance that you can receive for opioid treatment and how it gets to you from the settlement funds for opioid addiction. We will learn more with him on our next edition. I'm Adam Morgan. Do keep in touch. And many thanks to you as well for sharing a few moments of your weekend with us.